I'm Shersha Mizan from Hudson. You are listening to WGXC Accra 90.7 FM. Thank you.
WGXC underwriting support is provided in part by SunCommon, supporting vibrant communities across New York for 15 years, offering custom solar installations for homes, farms, and businesses. Information at suncommon.com.
WGXC is made possible in part by the generous ongoing support of Guillermo Rickerson of Cairo, New York. WGXC's sustaining supporters are among the station's most dedicated listeners. They care deeply about creative community radio, and their investment helps to sustain WGXC as a public platform for information, experimentation, and engagement in Greene and Columbia counties. Become a WGXC sustaining supporter today. Go to WGXC.org and click Donate. Thank you for your support.
You have the already global networks. So my argument is very simple. The present media is too large and wasteful. From now on, we should think about the more smaller media to diverse our culture and community. I have different idea on airwave. Airwave belongs to the every people, everybody, not to the states or a government. Okay, I will make the transmitter now. This is Paper Tiger Radio, special radio station. Telephone number is 212-420-9045.
Pedimos que por favor reporten al 420-9045. Estamos midiendo la fuerza de esta transmisión, una nueva emisora.
This is great.
That's what I have on VHS.
Independent narrowcasting.
Less than it costs to buy a real good radio.
I got all the way halfway down.
Did I tell you?
WNYU too. We're actually going over a really powerful station.
Really? Right? We're going over NYU?
Yeah, so if you can imagine, if we go on a space that's not being used, we can go even further.
Yeah. Not that there are a lot in New York. But keep yours close to the mic. These guys know what to call. We're really getting a lot of reach and a lot of distance. Nobody lives around here, that's the thing. Tell me if I'm going to bump into these guys. That's not them, is it?
You're listening to Waveforms WGXC 90.7 FM radio for open ears. This program is Bequency, and my name is Mayuko. Bequency invites the local community to be inspired by the joy, beauty, and wisdom bird enthusiasts find in the nature of our neighborhoods. Every episode features an interview with local bird people, plus a free-form mix of sound made by birds and humans inspired by birds. For today's episode, I spoke with Leslie Doyle, the president of the Rolif Jansen Historical Society in Kopek Falls. Leslie's kind and loving and often humorous observations of wildlife in her backyards in busy Manhattan and rural Hudson Valley remind us to appreciate the here and now wherever you are. The here and now is also the culmination of people's lives before us. Leslie shares how the New Deal era environmental improvement program restored the trees we see now in Kopek Falls. The trees had been devastated by the Kopek Ironworks, which was an iron extraction and production operation that played a crucial role in the local developments. I hope you enjoyed this conversation with Leslie as much as I did. Thanks for tuning in. This is Bequency. Okay, so could you briefly, well, introduce yourself and tell us what Rolif Jansen Historical Society is?
Okay, well, my name is Leslie Doyle, and I'm the current president of the Rolif Jansen Historical Society. And the society was formed actually nearly 50 years ago. This coming summer of 2024 will be our 50th anniversary. It was formed by the town historians of five towns, local towns, of Ankrum, Kopek, Hillsdale, Gallatin, and Taconic. And all of these are kind of united by the Rolif Jansen River. That's a major tributary to the Hudson River. It starts in Austerlitz and it goes all the way through Columbia County and empties at Lithgow into the Hudson River. And that's why everything is called Rojan in this area.
Yeah.
The Historical Society's mission probably best describes it, because we are charged with collecting and preserving and sharing local history, which we try to do. And we do this through programming. We do this through maintaining archives, maintaining an expanding collection, ever-expanding collection, and also through exhibitions. And we have a major exhibition every summer. So we are the repository of local history, and we have oral histories that we share. We have a very active website, and it's been our pleasure to really make everybody feel welcome there, and that their stories count and are important. And we have, you know, major objects, and we have like can openers from a local bar that closed that, uh-huh. that was important to people. So it's varied, and it's ever growing, ever expanding. And we're lucky enough also to be in to have our own home, which not every small town has. So we are in a former church, the old Copaic Methodist Church, which was built in 1892 and served the community for 63 years, but then in 1955 it was closed. The Methodist congregation was moved to Church Street in Copaic Flats, as they called it, and the church was closed for 28 years and abandoned. So neighbors sort of looked after it and mowed the grass, but the windows were broken, the roof started to leak, and so on. But the local community saved it and rescued it and repurposed it and gave it to the Historical Society. Mm-hmm. So that is our most significant object that's preserved, is the church building itself. And it's a wonderful place to exhibit and to have our programming.
Mm-hmm. I also really like that you have small things like can opener you mentioned.
Yes, indeed.
Because usually when people talk about history, it's often about, it's usually the winners side of the story.
Right.
People who are accomplished something big.
Right.
But local history.
And we have that too.
Right.
But we have the small
also,
things.
Yes. Right. Telling the story of.
And we're here to tell the story. Yes, indeed.
More ordinary people who lived here and who are around us. And I saw some similarity with that and the birding, because mm-hmm. when I started paying more attention to birds, I came to realize that it's not just about knowing birds, mm-hmm. but to know what's surrounding them. And, you know, you really have to understand the environment and the history around birds,
yes.
in order to understand bird itself.
Mm-hmm.
And so I came to sort of appreciate that. And we chatted a little bit about it when
mm-hmm.
we met, and
yes.
you mentioned also you're literally a birder. I mean, you love birds,
I do.
And we're sitting here mm-hmm. right by a bunch of birds in your own backyard. Something just came.
Oh, it's a titmouse. Yes.
But so I wanted to mm-hmm. ask you also about mm-hmm. your personal relationship with birds. You had a, you know, family episodes, and, you know, just how you, you know, have a...
Well, my parents were very invested in birds as well, and we had I grew up in a townhouse in Manhattan in the Chelsea neighborhood that was had a huge backyard, huge, you know, larger than the usual. And it had been when my folks first moved there, a lot of the buildings on our block, and this was in the very early 1950s, had been transformed into rooming houses. And it was a rundown waterfront neighborhood, and people started buying up these old buildings and renovating them and repurposing them and living in them. And we were lucky enough to have a woman from Tasmania, of all places,
oh.
who bought the house and did lots of wonderful work on it. And she was very tiny, and she was a horticulturist, and she became part of the, she was the head of the Horticultural Society in New York City mm. for a time. And she transformed what was basically just a muddy backyard. And in those days, people hung their laundry out. So mm. there were lots of laundry lines and laundry hanging. And she transformed this with flagstones. She made a deal with the police department to get manure from the Morgans, the horses, from the horse detail. There was a fish market around the corner, and she made a deal with those people to get the fish heads and enrich the soil, and it transformed it into this really magnificent garden. And my parents were, and when she finally decided to move back to, she moved to Perth, Australia, and she was a big bird fan also. She said to my parents, I would like to offer you first option to buy, because I think you'll love it and you'll take care of the garden. Mm-hmm. And of course, along with this beautiful garden, were birds. So we always had feeders, and And I didn't really know as a kid, you know, I knew, I appreciated it and so on, but I just didn't know the names of the birds. I knew a blue jay, I knew pigeons and so on, but they really sort of cultivated that, and eventually I understood what they saw in it and why they enjoyed it. If you'll look up here, if I can make this reference.
Yeah, yeah.
This is a Subway poster that my daughter gave me for my birthday, and it's got pigeons on it, and she knows how. So we've, the rock dove. Mm-hmm. So they're much derided as vermin, but I have always been very fond of pigeons. Anyway, when in adulthood, we had befriended two pigeons. One was named George, and he was flightless. And in front of the townhouse was an areaway with a gate, and all the houses down the block, which is very typical in New York City. And he remained in the gated area, and he would come when you called his name.
So he knows his name.
He knew his name. He knew. And he would sometimes go out the gate. And we would sort of be, when I picked up my daughter from school, we'd sort of hang out in front, and George would come out and visit with us. And if he'd start to go out, we'd say, George, come back. Anyway, so he lived with us for a couple of years and passed. Oh. But he had a great time.
You named him George, why?
My father named him George. I don't know why, he just thought he looked like a George. And then I had a very special relationship with a pigeon that we called Specky. And she was mostly white and with speckles. And I loved this pigeon. And she had, unfortunately, around her leg, she had gotten a string. And I could never get close enough to get it off of her, so she must have just gotten used to it. Mm. But when I would come home from work and be walking from 9th Avenue down, I would see her up in the, across the street on one of the windowsills, and I would make a special call to her, and she'd come swooping down, and I would feed her. And this went on for a couple of years, and one day she didn't come back, but so Specky, so everybody remembers Specky very well.
So neither are your pets, they're like more
they were
like
the
residents.
Outside, they were the outside birds, so, and then we had the blue jays and the other birds, lots of sparrows, of course, mm-hmm. which is a very urban bird, but those were two special bird relationships that we had in the city. And then when we moved up here, there was a tree, if I can once again reference where we have this arbor where we hang the bird feeders. Mm-hmm. There was a single tree there, and the previous owners had placed a feeder on branches that extended, so it was very symmetrical. So we just fell in love with the birds, and we would only come up on weekends, and the first thing that we would do is, of course, take the dog out and the cats if we had them, and then we'd rush out and fill the feeders right away. And anyway, so we just became avid bird fanciers and started to learn all their names, and friends have given us all the famous Sibley books and Peterson on birds, and it's just become a part of our life. And the first thing that you do in the morning, you make the coffee, and then you go out and feed the birds in all kinds of weather. Mm. And then, of course, getting to know them through the seasons is incredible.
Well, one thing I thought interesting that you told me about before was that, you know, a lot of people who feed birds, they sometimes like have some kind of hostility towards certain species. Like some people don't want squirrels come at their feeder. Some people don't want even like blue jays are sometimes, you know, despised.
They can be very aggressive, yeah.
Right, but you mentioned that you basically feed everybody who comes to your garden to the point where they don't even bother your vegetable garden, flowers,
no,
garden,
they don't. That,
which is for human.
Right,
so
exactly.
So you have gardens for human.
Yeah, that's in the front.
That's in the front.
And the back is all theirs, and it's about an acre. Mm-hmm. And so we have woods surrounding the property. And that's where the deer will pop out.
Mm-hmm.
And
so you get rabbits and you get some other little things too, and they all have their own share in your garden so that they don't bother your human garden.
They leave the garden. Yeah, they leave it alone. So we have daylilies out here, which sometimes the deer eat and sometimes they don't, but they're welcome to it. Mm-hmm. And then the little beds, or the large beds in the back, we have bee balm and things that are very bird friendly. And of course the hummingbirds have been, you know what, I never knew that the hummingbirds would come this close to the house, but we just have such a, they're so magical. So that's been a wonderful addition. And as I mentioned to you, so one of the great pleasures of looking out of these windows is we read about the animals and the birds, but then to see the behavior is very, very exciting. Mm-hmm. And you read about the groundhog, which is also called the woodchuck, and it's also called the whistle pig. One afternoon, as I was looking out, I heard this. And right in the straight back there, there's a burrow. I know where all their burrows are. And he was sitting up and whistling. And I said, oh my God, they really do whistle.
That's so cute. Was it your father who you told me about the woodchuck hunt?
Yes. So my parents were from a very small town in rural Indiana called Winchester. And he grew up hunting. And one day he was courting my mother. And so they were both from the same town, and my mother lived on a farm, a very huge and historical farm. It was very historic. It had been there for a long time. It had beautiful outbuildings and a beautiful house. And my Uncle Lloyd, her brother, ran it. And one day, my father said, well, let's... And he really, more than hunting, he wanted to just spend time with my mother. And so they said, we're going to go out into the woods, if that's okay with you, Lloyd, because he could be a little... It was a little nutty. And so Lloyd said, all these groundhogs, if you see any, please shoot them because they're driving me crazy and they're digging up my crops. So they walked into the woods and they came upon a tree that had a sort of a V in it with the trunks. And there was a groundhog stuck. It couldn't get out. And that's another thing about them that I was very surprised that they're very good climbers because we've seen them climb the trees in the back to get the pears. Anyway, so instead of shooting it, they spent the entire day getting him down. And it must have been, because they can be very ferocious. So they probably had to prod and do this and that, and they freed him. And that's really when he said, I'd really much rather help animals than to hunt them. So that was one of my favorite stories.
Yeah, I really loved parents. It when you told me that story.
So too. It changed his whole life. And another animal story I thought of was the time when I saw the possum play possum. And one day I was doing something out in the back, and I noticed that around this old gnarled tree, there were many turkey vultures. And I thought, what's going on? So I walked over, and they're pretty ferocious looking, and they're very big. So I said, what's going on? What's up? And so they sort of started to fly away, and that's when I looked over the hedge. And there was a possum lying there. And I thought, oh, my God, they've come to... And before I knew it, after they left, I saw the possum's nostrils flare. And he sort of came to. And it was as though he looked at me and he said, thanks. And waddled off. It was incredible.
Yeah, it's really funny. We do have a bunch of turkey vulture around here in Copenhagen.
And they serve a purpose. They, they keep the roads clear of roadkill.
You're listening to Be Quincy on WGXC 90.7 FM. If you're just joining us, we are listening to my interview with Leslie Doyle, the president of the Rolif Jansen Historical Society in Copake Falls, Columbia County. Thank you for listening.
May I tell one more story that's related to birds and animals? This must be about 6 years ago. We have right across from the auction house the little pond, which is a water source, and we've actually seen the fire truck filling up there, is an amazing thing to see. But the pond itself is called Folger's Pond. Mm-hmm. And one afternoon in August, I believe it was very hot. It was about 97 degrees. And we get a call from our neighbor. And she says, I just want to let you know that there's a bear taking a dip in Folger's Pond. Uh-huh. And we have incredible photographs of this. And he had come down from Tom's Hill, and he was hot, so he was taking a little dip. Uh-huh. And so she said, I just want to let you know, in case you're going to go out with a dog or whatever, and to take in your feeders. And of course, some places are very strict about in the spring you take your feeders in because the bears are waking up.
Right.
And they want the quick protein. Anyway, so we ran out and we got the feeders and took them in. And before I could get the last feeder in, which was given to me by a very dear friend and fellow bird lover, my good friend Alice Blome, She had given me a vintage thistle feeder that was the only thing left out there. And before I could go back, I went, oh my God. And that's when we still had the tree. Mm-hmm. And there was the bear hugging the tree and reaching up for this thistle feeder.
Oh no.
And I thought, oh no. So I tapped on the glass and he looked up and I said, please. He said, and it was really as though he said, okay, there's not much in there anyway. He got down and he sauntered away. And I have it still. So, anyway.
So all these forests around here, all these trees around here, they're all planted not so long time ago. And
that's true.
You know, I learned from Dave Decker, who's the land steward of the Rainstrom Hill Audubon Sanctuary, which is in Hillsdale, so not too far away from here. That's the first time I learned that forest there also is all man-made. It's been planted by Mr. Rainstrom.
You're right.
And before that, it had been a farmland. Mm-hmm. And when I talked to you, I learned from you that here in Kopek Falls, there's a similar history that these trees, the Taconic State Park and all that, they're not that old.
No.
And, you know, that such change of the natural environment directly affects the birds, you know, habitats and populations. So I was really curious about it when I heard from it. So maybe you can tell us, you know, what basically happened here.
Sure. Kopek Iron Works, as it was called until the early 20th century, attracted the Pomeroys because they discovered that there was iron ore very close by. And so there were all the right ingredients to have a furnace, as it were. And so they had the water from the Bashbish, water power. They had the woods all around the whole area, because you need wood to make charcoal, which burns much hotter than wood itself. And it had the iron ore, and then eventually the railroad. So they opened in 1845. The railroad started to come up here, and it's incredible to me how early it was. It was in 1852, so the Harlem Line started coming right into what they called Kopek Iron Works, and it's which is now the rail trail. And so all of these ingredients were there, but the trees were, if you look at old photographs of Kopek Falls, that whole area was denuded, literally. They chopped down all the trees. And colliers would be up in the woods making charcoal, and a lot of them came from France, apparently, where they had expertise. But the whole area was devastated in terms of its environment. It's an interesting question because the bird population probably really dwindled. And eventually they learned, and I guess environmentalism was a thing of the future, but they discovered that they needed the trees to keep the land from eroding. So they started to have flooding, and it became, you know, a very bad situation. And they also ran out of iron ore. So at that time, in about 1903, they closed the iron works. And happily for us, two families, including the Masters, who are still here, Edgar Masters is still very, very involved with the iron works, and his grandparents had a huge amount of acreage, which they donated to become parkland. So that is one of the bases of Taconic State Park. And the ore bed, where this ore was mined for many, many years, has become a wonderful swimming place, which is called the ore bed still. And slowly but surely, things started to come back. And then it was starting in 1933, you asked me about the Civilian Conservation Corps, which is one of the FDR's, Franklin Delano Roosevelt, President Roosevelt's, he lived not far from here in Hyde Park, and he was very invested in parkland and conservation. And so the Civilian Conservation Corps was organized, and it was a way during the Depression of employing people. And it was young men apparently who from the ages of 15 to 25 or so. And it went from 1933 to 42, and they planted thousands and thousands and thousands of trees. And that's where you get the new growth from. So it was really, another wonderful part of the New Deal. And we have all benefited from it, and including the birds and the wildlife. So
yeah,
it's
sure.
become very well populated again. And there was a lesson to be learned, and I think that at that time people were beginning to realize that you had to, the Dust Bowl in the Midwest, you had to rotate the crops, otherwise you would just, you know, you couldn't grow. You couldn't, it was, the soil was not rich enough to grow anything, and if you had the misfortune of drought, you had everything just blew away.
Right.
So people were learning these lessons, and that was a very good part of it, and we've all benefited, all of us, from it.
Mm-hmm. It's kind of incredible because it's only lasted about 60 years. I mean, Iron Works itself had such large impact in the environment. I mean, we can ruin things in such short period of time.
Such a short period of time. So, and I guess when they first came here, it was just, you know, the untold, I mean, what people must have thought when they came to this country. Mm-hmm. For the first time, and just saw nothing but woodland, and of course, then that it had to be cleared for agriculture,
right?
Had to be tamed, roads had to be built, but certainly an example of the economic engine. I mean, it employed many people, and it also the ironworks also brought people here,
right?
So that was where the population really increased, and people of all kinds and all backgrounds came.
Mm-hmm.
And they hopped on the railroad, and I think I mentioned that, you know, the when the Irish during the potato famine came to New York City, they were not welcome, and there were signs saying Irish need not apply. So Lemuel Pomeroy, the first owner of the ironworks, said, "Hop on the train and come on up, and I'll hire you." And that was really remarkable. So,
but it's also a little hopeful story too, because. Mm-hmm. When we see the landscape here, it's so rich in terms of nature now.
It is.
And the Civilian Conservation Corps, they only were active for like 10 years, 1930s to 40s.
And then I guess what really happened, well, the thing about 1942, it was, you know, everybody went to war. In Europe and in the Pacific, you know, the many theaters of the war, but so, and in a funny way, it was preparing people for that, in the sense that they worked in unison, and they had all these, you know, they learned all of this, these techniques of environmental conservation and so on. So
you're listening to Frequency on WGXC 90.7 FM. If you are just joining us, we're listening to my interview with Leslie Doyle, the president of the Rolif Jansen Historical Society in Copake Falls, Columbia County.
So you mentioned that 2024 is 50th anniversary.
Yes, of the Historical Society.
The Historical Society. Is there any events happening?
Well, it's interesting because it's also the bicentennial of Copake itself.
Oh,
so we've been here for 200 years. So we will be doing a show about the five hamlets of Copake.
Mm-hmm.
And there will be many events that picnics and special programs and tours. And so we've been charged with doing the exhibit, which is a privilege, really. And I don't know if you know the building right down the road where when you turn into Copake, you pass the auction house.
Mm-hmm.
And you come to the first meeting house, which is sort of partially and not very well renovated. But anyway, that was where the first town meeting was, so in 1824. And so we will fit in our celebration into that because, you know, we're sort of central to the preservation of the history of the area. So that should be exciting.
And, yeah. Do you know what? I'm sure you know the train depot at the end of Copake Hamlet?
Yes.
Somebody's renovating.
Yes, a woman named Stephanie Sharp.
With a, what do you call that?
Like a caboose.
A caboose. So what's the story of that place?
So I think people despaired of it for years. You know, what are we going to do about it? And who can, and it's on a wetland, and it's And it's sort of, you know, it's in very bad condition. And that was for a different railroad line. That was for the CNE, the Connecticut New England line.
Oh.
Because there were many railroads, and that one has disappeared also.
Was it connected to Harlem Valley Rail?
No, it was a completely separate thing.
Oh,
yeah.
Interesting.
And there was also a Poughkeepsie line. So the train was, you know, very essential.
Mm-hmm.
So people despaired of it, and what are we going to do about it? And the young woman who has bought the property, and also the old school near Empire Road, the old Copaic School, and she's from Australia.
Oh.
And this is her passion. And she's renovating the school, and she's going to have her offices there.
Mm-hmm.
And I think her husband is working with her on all of this. And then she bought the depot, which we never thought would happen. I mean, it was just like a miracle. So she's going to do probably some sort of, I think, a little museum and maybe have a B&B there.
Mm.
But it will sort of enliven that part of town. And it's another very important aspect of the history of the town itself.
So there will be a lot of events happening in 2024.
Yes, there will.
Listeners can find information on the website.
And the town website.
And the town website.
So we have a bicentennial committee that meets monthly. And there's going to be a play. Somebody's writing a play about the first meeting.
Oh.
So it's really kind of amazing.
Uh-huh.
And
are they doing it at the Grange?
The Grange, yes.
I keep forgetting the word. Grange.
Grange. And Grange, you associate with, that was where you would store the grain.
Oh, so that's easy.
That's a good way
that
to
makes
remember.
It, yeah, Grange.
So, okay. But that was a very important, it was formed right after the Civil War, the Grange. And it's nationwide, and it was really for farming families, sort of to provide culture and a place to meet and a place to learn. And the science was very invested in the science of agriculture. Mm. So it has a very interesting history. So we consider all of these our sister organizations. So
right.
We do, you know, collaborations and so on.
Makes sense.
So that's come back to life. It had, you know, what, 7 years ago there were, you know, hardly any members, and now they've got at least 120 active members. So that's very exciting.
Mm-hmm.
And it's a very, very, as I say, it's a very, very old organization.
Yeah. I mean, the more people pay attention to their immediate neighborhood and environment, just like bird conservation
exactly.
is the same.
Exactly.
You know, we humans have to live. We need jobs, and development is necessary for many of us to survive and thrive. But we have to also find a way to be mindful and protect the natural environment at the same time. So it's always interesting to hear stories about how people have resolved such tension between nature conservation and human lives, like the story we heard today. So huge thanks to Leslie Doyle for taking time for this interview. You can find the information of the events happening at Rolif Jansen Historical Society and in the town of Copaic on their websites, which are rolifjansenhs.org. Rolif Jansen HS is a one word. Rolif Jansen Historical Society, HS, one word. I'm sure you can Google it. And the town of Copaic is just that, townofcopaic.org, town of C-O-P-A-K-E, townofcopaic.org, that's one word. And in addition to the events that celebrate the 200th anniversary of the town of Copaic, Rolif Jansen Historical Society is taking part in Winter Walk, that is happening on next weekend on Sunday, December 3rd, from noon to 4 p.m. And I asked Leslie to tell us about it, this winter walk, a little bit, and here's what she said.
So Winter Walk is something that happens every year in Copaic Falls, and it's the entire community of Central Copaic Falls. So many things to do, including coming to the Rolif Jansen Historical Society, where we have a large display of vintage Santa Clauses and many editions of The Night Before Christmas. And we also have a Santa Claus, and this year we have a new one who is a former football player.
New Santa Claus.
New Santa Claus, and he's had lots of experience working with special needs kids, and after he retired from the NFL, and he's been a Santa many times before, so we were very, very lucky to find him, and he lives right in Copaic Falls. Mm-hmm. And then we have beautiful wreaths from Vinegate Lavender Farm, and then we're going to have wonderful cards, and we have cider, and we have baked goods, and all sorts of, it's a fun event. And then on the 6th, which is St. Nicholas Day, a woman named Pamela McCall is going to come and talk about her book called 'Twas the Night, and it's all about the history of the night before Christmas, which is actually called A Visit from St. Nicholas, but we all know it as the night before Christmas, when all through the house, not a creature was stirring, not even a mouse. And she's going to tell us the whole history of the poem, which is now 200 years old, and it was published first in Troy, New York, even though it was written in Manhattan. So they should be wonderful holiday festive events. So.
Mm-hmm. Okay, thank you very much.
Sure.
So that's the information. You know, you might want to find out about this new Santa Claus. Apparently, I missed the opportunity to meet the old Santa Claus. We lost the old Santa Claus. I missed the chance to meet the Santa Claus, the real Santa Claus. But we have a new Santa Claus. We always have. We always do. And so, again, you can find out the information at rolifjansenhs.org. And now, it's time to listen to some bird-inspired music, as always. So Leslie and her husband, Nick, are apparently, I didn't know about this, but also the people behind Lyricord Discs, which is a renowned record label specialized in music from around the world, and early classical music. So I would like to play some bird theme song from their catalog. We're going to start with a song titled Swallows Return When Willows Are Green by Lui Hung with Chinese Orchestra, and it is from an album titled Chinese Folk Songs. So I hope you enjoy the music. Thank you for listening. This is Frequency on WGXC 19.7 FM.
Bye.
The last track we just heard is titled Hamachidori, and that was Japanese stuff. This is from an album titled Japanese Masterpieces for the Koto. It's a release from Lyricord Discs record label that Leslie has been behind of this record label apparently, which I find it like really cool, because I I learned of this record label back when I was still in New York City, and I was doing a show at WFMU. They have a library. They have a pretty big library, and I think that was where I first encountered. And it's either the Japanese traditional thing or Tibetan ritual music, either one of those. And my friend Daniel there, you know, basically handed me over the stuff and say, like, you know, check out the music. But I just didn't hear. You know, we didn't pronounce the word lyric chord. So when Leslie first mentioned it, it didn't like register in my mind that's the label she was talking about. And, you know, DJs, maybe some other DJs may be talking intelligent stuff, but me and my friend are basically like, you should check out this stuff, it's cool. You know, that kind of level of vocabulary. So I just didn't hear the name like pronounced before. So, but when I recognized what she was talking about, I thought, this is like super cool that this is our neighbor in Columbia County. But anyhow, Hamachidori, the reason why I played it is because it means the, you know, plover, the bird plover. And this recording didn't have the lyrics, but seems like some other recordings, like some other versions, have singers in it, and the words are referring to like I said, plovers, which is what the title means also. And the lyrics were supposedly taken from Kokin Wakashu, which is a collection of poems from around the year 900 or something like that. Not that I know anything. Just because I'm from there doesn't mean I know anything. But and so, if you have any questions about these music, please ask the president of the Rolf Jansen Historical Society. And before that was a track from an album titled Traditional Music of Vietnam, and it was titled Song of Nightingale is the track we heard. And we're going to close today's show with an excerpt of a new release. I want to play a new release also, and it is titled Local Exoticism, like exotic exoticism. I'm not exactly sure I'm pronouncing it correctly, but anyhow, this is by an artist named John Baptiste Geoffroy. It's an artist. I shouldn't address people. They're an artist who lives on the bank of Loire River in France, and the artist describes this project as. It says, I started recording as regularly as possible in the restricted parameter, in places where I like to walk close to my home, a radius of no more than 2 kilometers around my house, and the life it fosters is thus explored here, with a